For the week of February 16th, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 225, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
So you're still in New York, Michael, and I guess you've been traveling around, though, so you're in different parts of New York then.
That's right. I'm in upstate New York right now.
Okay, but it's still snowing everywhere.
Oh, it's snowing here, that's for sure. I got to shovel the sidewalk in a few minutes. Boy, that's fun. 14 snowstorms in New York this season. And so, you know, I didn't care normally because I didn't have a car. I didn't have sidewalks I was responsible for. Now I got to dig out a car. I got to shovel a sidewalk. It's a pain in the neck. So, you know, I could be doing better. But how are you doing?
Everything is awesome. Everything is cool.
Okay, everything's awesome. I get it.
Now, to all of our listeners, I dare you to get that song out of your head.
Well, it's from the Lego movie, the biggest hit of the year.
That's true. Yes.
Yeah. Well, we are. Everything's better when you're part of a team. And I guess we're a podcast team. And, you know, at the start of the show, we have the sad little fact.
I don't know what it's become of this show where, like, the first 2 minutes of the show, we talk about obituaries for some reason.
Yes. Let's
open with obituaries.
Yeah, that's always a winner. Shirley Temple died.
Yes.
There you go. That's a cheery thought. She was 85-year-old. She was the biggest star in the world for 4 years in a row. 1935, 1936. 1937, 1938, that cute little girl pulled us through the Depression. And then by 1940, she was dropped by her studio.
Well, don't you mean she was
puberty hits? When puberty hits, they don't want to see you anymore.
Don't you mean she was the biggest little star?
No, she was the biggest star, period.
No, but she was
tiny. She
was
the biggest child star of all time. And she was the biggest star, bigger than Gable, bigger than anyone. She was it.
But she wasn't very tall. You see, I'm making
No, she was a little kid. I got that.
I'm making a height joke here, okay?
Yeah. She was so valuable to 20th Century Fox, they refused to loan her out to MGM for The Wizard of Oz. They loaned her out for a few movies and said, why are we doing this? So, you know, if you read the obituary in the New York Times, it was fascinating. A creepy thing from Graham Greene, the novelist. An unpleasant thing to find out about Arthur Freed, which I didn't know, but check that out. It's very interesting.
What is this? How would you allude to this and then not tell us?
Oh, well, Graham Greene had a review where he reviewed Wee Willie Winkie because he reviewed films as well as being a novelist at some period in his life. And, you know, he's a great, great author. Of course, The Quiet American and so many other great books. But he accused them of maybe that she was a midget.
Oh.
And he didn't seem to be joking. And he said that the studio was luring middle-aged men with her nubile, appealing little body. And you're kind of like, yeah, you're actually telling us more about you, Graham Greene, than about Shirley Temple or her studio. Creepy. And then apparently when she went to MGM after she left Fox and was dumped, I should say, Arthur Freed exposed himself to her. Arthur Freed, the famed head of the Freed Unit, the big musical division, I guess is how you put it, at MGM, one of the most powerful people in Hollywood, a fixture for decades. He apparently exposed himself to her in his office on her first day there. She was completely clueless about, this is from her autobiography, by the way. She's completely clueless about the male anatomy. She says she burst out laughing and he angrily threw her out of his office.
And that's how she lost the role. What role was she supposed to play in The Wizard of Oz?
No. That had nothing to do with that. No, okay. That was years earlier. No. She was an adult there. She was starting to work for MGM and he was sexually harassing her. He just threw her out of his office, but she didn't lose her contract with MGM. She made movies, but that nothing to do with him. Didn't hurt her career prospects as such. But if he did that to her, you can imagine he must have done that to a lot of other children and young women. So, you know, that's a horrible thing to know.
Okay. I'm almost sorry I asked now, but
Well, yeah, it's creepy and awful. But the one thing I'll always remember about her is the Oscars. She came back. She didn't do a lot. You know, she had a big career after movies, a very successful career as a politician, a diplomat.
Right.
She, you know, made a real life for herself, which is, you know, in this day and age, as we see with child actors and actors in general, you know, thank God she had a stable, happy life well beyond her Hollywood career. That's not easy to do. But she came back from one of the Oscars where they said, oh, bring back all the big Oscar winners or all the stars. And they were showing each actor was that horrible thing where you have like an applause competition, you know,
right.
Here's, you know, Jane Wyman or whatever. But they came to Shirley Temple Black, and the roar of just, oh, Shirley Temple, the roar of like just glee and happiness to see her was so genuine and so like real. And her face just lit up. Oh, it's so pleased, you know, like, oh, that's nice.
What year was this? Do you remember?
80s, 90s. I don't know.
Yeah, okay.
But it was really, really touching. I'll always remember that moment. And of course, she's not the only one. Another big figure, Sid Caesar, is dead. And yes. Most people under 50 probably don't care.
Yeah,
they don't know
who
he is. Yeah. They don't know what he did. His heyday was so long ago. It was 60 years ago. His influence really happened in the 50s. That's when he was important and really mattered. And his influence has continued on right up to today. But he really did nothing after that. He had roles. He had this and that. But he was really not an important person after that key period when he did so much for early television.
Yeah, I guess he was the king of the doublespeak.
That's right, the little nonsense talk. But he was the host of your show of shows, the big early sketch comedy show. It launched in 1950, and so many people came out of that writing room. I mean, Woody Allen, Mel Brooks, Carl Reiner, on and on, Neil Simon. So many people that went on and influenced comedy in so many ways. And, of course, the sketch comedy show itself. I mean, people talk about TV being a wasteland and the idiot box. That story, that argument ended in 1950 with your show of shows. It was very smart. It was a huge hit. It was very clever and well done. And they're doing it live without teleprompters. Forget Saturday Night Live today where you see them standing there woodenly reading a thing. These people were doing it live 90 minutes every week from memory. It was just a great, great show.
Kind of like what we do every week. 90 minutes, even though we say we're only an hour. And it's live, and so we don't have cue cards at all. We have some notes in front of us, but, you know, really, why do we do this? We do this for our audience. Many of you, by the way, subscribe to our show on iTunes or in the Microsoft Marketplace or wherever they give podcasts away for free, and we appreciate you doing that. We appreciate it when you rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It really does help us out, and we love it when you send us email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. We even received a few phone calls this week to 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263, a toll-free number. You can call and leave us a voicemail. Of course, we have Twitter and Facebook accounts. We'll tell you all that at the end of the show, but I did just want to point out that you could subscribe to the show just in case you were wondering.
Well, good to know. And this is your podcast of podcasts. And what will we be covering today?
Well, since we read the trade papers, so you don't have to, on today's show, we're going to be joined by David Gelis, the business reporter for The New York Times, who's going to help us explain the big news of the past week. Of course, we're talking about the $45 billion merger of Comcast and Time Warner Cable.
Potential merger.
Oh, yeah. Heaven help us. We'll also tell you about the BAFTA Awards, which were held in London on Sunday evening. Like many of the awards previously handed out for the year's top movies, the BAFTAs spread the love around mostly between 12 Years a Slave and Gravity, but we'll fill you in. We'll head over to Germany to fill you in on something else. This year's Berlinale, that ended over the past, I guess over the weekend, and they handed out some awards. Everybody's getting awards but us. What's the big deal? Speaking of big deals and big whoops, that's when we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
No, I won't do it.
Okay, so wait.
It's the worst weekend of the year, if not my life, for movies. Why? Because they turned not one, but two of my favorite books of all time, I'm not exaggerating, into god-awful, terrible, bad movies.
So you're saying that your one of your favorite books is the Lego Movie?
No.
Then it must one be Beijing Love Story.
No, it's Endless Love by Scott Spencer, which is a great novel, this is the second time they've turned it into a god-awful movie. The first time was in the 80s.
But at least this one didn't star Brooke Shields.
That would be fine. I have nothing against Brooke Shields. Okay. I just want the movie to be good. This movie, dreadful. The last movie, dreadful. The book, brilliant. Really a great, great novel by Scott Spencer, a terrific novelist. He's done many good books since then. This was a out-of-left-field bestseller, really. It was his second or third book, I think. It sold millions of copies and then was turned into a movie so bad, it kind of poisoned the reputation of the book. People don't even know that they should read it. But if you like literary fiction, it's a great novel. And then there's Winter's Tale, a Dickensian fantasy by Mark Helprin, another one of my favorite novelists. I love this book. He's probably best at short stories, but I love his big, fat, old-fashioned novels. And this one, if you have any interest in a Dickensian tale with touches of a flying horse and fantastical elements, and you're willing to accept a book that talks about truth and beauty and art with, like, capital letters, it's a bit of purple prose, I'll give you that. But I love the book. I read it as a young person, as a kid. I fell in love with it. I like a lot of his writing. He's a very good writer. terrific novel, really loving to me, really important to me, and it's been turned into a horrible, horrible movie, Winter's Tale. Both of them came out. One of them was a flop.
Now before you continue, Michael, and I probably should say this in front of our audience so that they understand what's going on.
Or behind the audience.
Well, yeah, but just so that they understand what's going on here, I don't want you to hold back on your feelings. I want you to tell us exactly what you think.
Well, I didn't see these movies.
Oh, okay.
I don't even want to see the trailer. I saw the trailer for Endless Love. I stopped myself from watching the trailer for Winter's Tale.
Yeah.
I didn't go see Cloud Atlas. That's a great novel. It should not have been turned into a film. If everybody said it was great, I would have gone. If everybody gave these movies good reviews, I'd say, okay, I'll give it a try. But they were pilloried by the critics and fairly rejected by the people. But one of them was cheap enough that'll probably make money. So that brings us to the movies that did make money. The number one movie around the world, according to RentTrack, which is where we get our source for how much movies have made around the globe. It's the best and only source that we have right now. Their number one movie around the world is The Lego Movie. That's the song that you played at the beginning of the movie. That's the theme song in a way. It made $76 million. So everything is awesome for Warner Brothers. It's made almost $200 million worldwide. It's a huge hit. It just started to open up internationally. It's doing really well domestically. Word of mouth is off the charts. Everybody likes this movie.
Now, before we continue, I went to see the Lego Movie with my children over the weekend. Uh-huh. And I used my Movie Pass, so a little plug for Movie Pass there. But not that we need to be plugging people. But I went to an AMC, and at this AMC movie theater here in the United States, they have like reserved seating, which I know is very popular elsewhere in the world, but is only now just kind of becoming a thing here in North.
Well, they've tried. It's not taken hold. I mean, there's like one theater in New York. They've tried at certain times to push it. Maybe it's taken hold in LA, but it's certainly not gaining traction in America in general, I wouldn't think.
No. And I can tell you that for a children's movie on a Sunday afternoon, doing reserved seating, especially when parents are coming back from the bathroom with the popcorn and the kids, and not a very good idea. In fact,
why?
There were fights.
You have to have attendance in the theater to shepherd that and to oversee that. Because if you don't have attendance in the theater, ushers to make clear, no, these are reserved seats, blah, 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 then it gets to be very ugly.
Yeah. Well, what wasn't ugly was the fact that literally every seat in the house was taken.
Oh, wow. That's really good. Did you like it?
I did like it. Yes. Everything about it was awesome.
Number two around the world is RoboCop, the first of three movies to be remade from the 80s. The others are About Last Night, which is based on a David Mamet play, and Endless Love, which of course starred Brooke Shields and a young Tom Cruise in a tiny little part. Three movies from the 80s. You know you're getting old when you're covering the revival or the remake of movies that you covered the first time around.
Yeah, you know what's funny is I thought the same exact thing this past weekend.
You can't help it. It made $56 million. It's been open overseas for a little bit, so it's crossed the $100 million mark. So it's not doing great. It had a weak opening in the U.S. It was third. It cost a lot of money to make. It cost $100 million, so it needs to triple where it's at right now. Maybe it'll do. We'll have to see. It's going to need that money overseas. That's where it needs to make the bucks. And number three is About Last Night. This is a remake of the film from the 80s that starred members of the Brat Pack. This one stars an African-American cast predominantly. It's another movie starring Kevin Hart, who has a big hit, of course, with Ride Along, and before that, his concert film. So he's the hottest star in Hollywood right now. And this movie, About Last Night, just like Ride Along, who knows if they'll ever release it overseas?
You know, what's interesting is that, at least here in North America, About Last Night beat out RoboCop. So you know you're in trouble when your big sci-fi action film does not beat out, you know, the kind of romantic comedy.
No, that's a point. Either it does well or it doesn't. It's not, oh, if it had only beat About Last Night, it would be doing okay. It didn't do well for what its budget was. About Last Night did great because it doubled its budget on opening weekend. It made $26 million. Its budget, $28 million, I should say. Its budget is $12.5 million. At least that's what they claim. So that's the comparison. It doesn't matter how it does in relation to another movie. You can't say, oh, romantic comedies need to make more money than big. Well, if it's a bigger budget, it needs to make more money. It could have been a $100 million romantic comedy like Town and Country with Jack Nicholson and Diane Keaton. You got to make a lot of money if you cost a lot of money. But comparing it to another movie like, RoboCop didn't beat the comedy. Well, so what?
Well,
what if they both made $80 million? What if About Last Night made $80 million and RoboCop made $70 million? Then they both would have done well.
It's not a
zero sum game here. Lots of movies can be successful at the same time.
But how much more would RoboCop have made if About Last Night wasn't being released this week? That's what studio executives want to know.
Not a penny more. At number four around the world is Beijing Love Story. I'm going to guess it's a Chinese film about a romance.
Yes.
It made $25 million. And in fact, it's based on a TV show, right? This is the one that's based on the TV show, isn't it? Yes, it is. It stars Tony Leung. If I'm saying his name right, he's a big star in Asia. We've seen him in a lot of movies. It's spun off from a TV series and has the same creator and the same cast making the movie, but it's not the TV show. They're telling an entirely new story with entirely new characters. So that's a little odd. It's like Friends, but suddenly they're different people. But that's interesting. It's another TV spinoff making the jump to the big screen in China and a couple other territories. And number five around the world, Frozen. Continues to make tons of money. Another $24 million. It's at $955 million worldwide. It's the third highest grossing animated film of all time, I think, with not counting re-releases. And guess what? It's going to cross $1 billion.
Wow.
At number six is The Monuments Men, the George Clooney film. We knew older audiences would take their time to discover it and get out to it. They seem to be liking it. My mom certainly did. It made $24 million. It's at $55 million worldwide. And it's just starting to open up overseas, and that's where we think it's going to make a lot of its money. So when all is said and done, it'll probably be okay. We'll have to see. It costs $70 million to make, and it's got a long road ahead of it, but there's a lot of territories to come.
George, at number seven, George Clooney, that hack.
At number seven is Endless Love. It opened to $19 million. And you know what? It only cost, what was it, $12 million? I forget what Endless Love cost. It cost $20 million to make. I was confusing it with About Last Night. This movie costs $20 million to make, so it needs to make at least $50 million in order to get okay. We'll have to see. It should do it probably. With a modest multiple of 2.5, it'll be okay. And number eight is The Wolf of Wall Street. This grossed $16 million around the world. It's at $307 million and counting. And I told you at the top that our figures come from RentTrack, and I come not to praise RentTrack, but to bury them.
Oh.
I don't know why.
Why?
I don't know why, but The Wolf of Wall Street, under their data, is missing about $23 million. When you look at the numbers and The Hollywood Reporter and Variety and others, they all have this movie with $23 million more overseas than RentTrack does. And I said, oh my God, are all their figures this flawed? And I went through all the other movies, and from everything I can determine, they're up to date with all the other films, but for some reason, there's this quirk that they do not have all the data on The Wolf of Wall Street. We should have known that it was passing $300 million worldwide and was Martin Scorsese's biggest movie of all time. We should have known that last week. But because we were missing that $23 million, we dropped the ball. But
well, I wouldn't say we dropped the ball because we were relying on other sources.
That's right. RentTrack is great. They're the only people who regularly cover worldwide box office. Variety and How the Reporter have stories occasionally, most weeks, but not every week, and they're not consistent in what they do. I think Variety has a little chart where they list the top 10 international grosses.
Right.
But RentTrack is the only one that combines it all. It's the only one that covers all of them every week and puts all the info together one place. We have to piece it together otherwise. So they do a great job. I'm not sure what happened with this movie, but we've suddenly discovered an extra $23 million for The Wolf of Wall Street. Martin Scorsese is happy.
Well, you know, I'm always happy when I find an extra $23 million lying around.
Absolutely. At number nine is The Monkey King. This is the Chinese film. It grossed another $13 million. It's about to hit $150 million. That's in basically a few Asian territories, about eight countries right now. Big, big hit. They've already announced there's going to be a sequel, but they won't tell you what it's about until this movie has finished its run at the box office. I don't know why, because it's based on a book that everybody knows. So
yeah, it's like a classic tale. So
there's no secrets to be revealed. So I'm not quite sure why they're keeping the lid on it, but there will be a sequel to The Monkey King.
Yeah, don't tell me how Lord of the Rings ends either.
Yeah. And number 10 is Winter's Tale. This is the film, the directorial debut of screenwriter Akiva Goldsman. It stars Colin Farrell, and it's based on the novel by Mark Halperin that I love. And
Akiva Goldsman won an Academy Award for what movie?
Was it Dangerous Mind? I mean, A Beautiful Mind?
Yes, I did not think you would get that, but yes, it was.
Oh, well, good for me. Yes, this is Winter's Tale. It opened at number seven in North America. It cost $60 million to make. And, you know, when you look at the budgets for all these movies, boy, Hollywood is claiming they're a lot smarter in their budgets, aren't they? So many movies cost so much less than you would think. I mean, the Lego movie cost $60 million? Really?
Well, you know, maybe, because they did produce it overseas and, you know, they did not.
I know, but it's hard to make an animated film that's not junky looking for less than $100 million. You know, About Last Night cost $12 million. Endless Love cost $20 million. Ride Along, $25 million. I just, The budgets are so... That awkward moment with Zac Efron cost $8 million to make. The budgets are so much smaller now than they were 10 or 20 years ago. You'd think Hollywood just suddenly had a slim fast diet or something. It just is a little perplexing that budget would be so much lower than they were 20 years ago.
Well, you know, I foresee a lawsuit where somebody claims that they're not being paid royalties or a part of the profit that they deserve based on the fact that in Variety or The Hollywood Reporter or RentTrack, somebody was quoted as saying the budget was $12.5 million. The movie made $400 million, so there should be a profit somewhere.
Well, that happens historically. It always happens, right?
But now since Hollywood is trying to downplay these budgets...
Right, now it's even harder for them to claim, well, but that doesn't include...
Right.
Yeah.
That doesn't include the hammer we bought, which cost $50 million.
From NASA, apparently.
Yeah,
so Winter's Tale opened at $12 million. It opened in here in the U.S. and 26 other territories. Obviously, Canada and 25 other territories, I should say. So it's in dozens of countries. It made $12 million. Terrible reviews. Not a good start. Read the book. At number 11 is The Man from Macau. We talked about it before. Another $10 million. It's at $67 million and counting. At number 12, American Hustle. Also $10 million. That's at the $200 million mark worldwide. That is a lot of money for this movie. I mean, again, he does not make movies that seem geared towards box office, but he makes money every time.
Well, it costs $40 million to make. The he in this instance is director David O. Russell.
That's right. And number 13 is Kevin Hart's other movie in the box office sweepstakes right now, Ride Along. Another $8 million, $116 million, not worldwide, just North America, because they may not even bother to release it overseas. And that's really Pennywise and Pound Foolish. You want to build them up into a star. And number 14, here's a movie that's interesting. The Three Brothers, The Return. It's
I was hoping that you would do the French pronunciation.
Ah, trois frères, le return. I don't know. I don't know how to say it.
Can't you do some of that Sid Caesar doublespeak?
Yeah. I'm not as good as Sid Caesar. This is interesting. I knew nothing about this. There was a movie in 1995, I think. Was it 85? 95, I think, called The Three Brothers. And it starred this French sketch comedy troupe called The Unknowns. They broke out on stage, then they had a hit TV series, then they made this movie, and then their manager sued them, they sued their manager, and it all fell apart, and they felt like they couldn't work together again, because if they did, then the manager would have a right and a claim to what they did. So they all split apart. Two of them would make this movie, two would make that movie, they would do this, they would do that, and they all, whatever, it all broke apart. And they all came back together.
There's a lot of this and that going on in your story here.
Oh, sorry about that. Well, nonetheless, we don't know. I don't know the details. I learned as much as I could, but their manager put a kibosh on the whole group by trying to, you know, force more money out of them or who knows what. But they broke up. Very famous, very popular. They broke up. And now, I guess all things have been mended. They've worked through their legal woes. And now they made a sequel. This is, 19 years later, they've made a sequel. It's the three guys together again. Didier Bourdon, Bernard Campan. And I love this guy's name, Pascal Legitimus. It sounds like something from Asterisk and Obelix. But anyway, they've made this movie. It's opened in France and perhaps some other territories. Nope, just France. $6.5 million. So welcome back, The Unknowns. And number 16 is Jack Ryan's Shadow Recruit, $6 million. It's at $122 million worldwide. Then Miss Granny, the Chinese film we talked
about.
Actually,
South Korean.
$5.6 million. It's just about to hit $50 million. And then that Zac Efron movie, which cost pennies to make, that awkward moment, that's about to hit $50 million worldwide. And finally, an Italian film called Sotto una buona stella, which is born under a lucky star, or under a lucky star, I should say. And it's an Italian comedy co-written and directed and starring Carlo Verdone, who is a big player in Commedia Italiana, a particular genre of film in Italy. He's also the star of The Great Beauty by Paolo Sorrentino, which is one of the big hits of the year and is a very strong Oscar hopeful for Best Foreign Film. You know, he's having a career year. He's got a film he directed and starred in. He starred in Sorrentino's movie. That's gotten critical acclaim all over the world. So he's having a great
time. And that
great
movie
time.
That you're referring to is La Gran Bellezza, The Great
That's
Beauty.
That's right. Well done. And talk about Born Under a Lucky Star. And finally, there's Mr. Peabody and Sherman, which opens up here soon, if not this weekend. It's a spinoff from an old TV show here in North America about a time-traveling dog and his boy. Pal companion. It made $5 million. It's at about $10 million in four territories. I don't know where it's playing. I don't know why they went to see it. It doesn't look like it's going to be any good, but we'll have to see what happens.
I will tell you that when the trailer for this film played before the Lego movie,
oh, did it?
Everybody the whole audience, I say everybody as if somehow I was eyeing and ooing as well, but they were all excited. So I kind of went, I wonder if this is going to be a big hit. It certainly seems that way from the reaction.
That's weird. I mean, because it has no name recognition, I wouldn't think, anymore.
I know, but they've been playing that trailer before movies for, it seems like, 6 months.
Well, the reviews were a little problematic in the trades. They felt like it had sort of a weird take on it, and they weren't sure how it would play. So we'll have to see what happens.
True. Well,
but we know what happened overseas, don't we, at the BAFTAs?
That's true. We do. It looks like Gravity took home, what, 6 awards, including Best Director and Best British Film. That's right. Even though Warner Brothers produced the film and released the film here in the United States and elsewhere around the world, it is a British film. However, 12 Years a Slave picked up, I guess, some of the bigger prizes. Chiwetel Ejiofor was named Best Actor, and it won the big prize of the night, Best Film.
But does this tell us anything?
No, it does not.
All we know is that the British like the British.
Yes, that's pretty much
what... Alfonso Cuarón is not British, but he's lived there for many years. He's part of the film community. He made one of the Harry Potter films. What could be more British than that? Chiwetel Ejiofor is British. Steve McQueen is the director of 12 Years a Slave. He's British. I feel like they were just reporting their own, and I don't think it brings any clarity to the Oscars whatsoever.
Kind of like the BAFTAs every single year.
Well, no. I mean, if an American triumphs there...
Well, yes, if they triumph there, you know, it's pretty much a foregone conclusion that they're going to make it over at the Oscars.
No, it's not a foregone conclusion, but it's a good sign of momentum and people celebrating. Again, these are not people that there's a lot of overlap in the voting for the Oscars.
Yeah.
But as far as how the film community feels and momentum, blah, 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 it's better than not winning.
That's
true. Did Judi Dench win?
I don't know.
I shouldn't have asked that because I didn't know the answer. But yes, Judi Dench, she's hoping to be some crazy upset. It's not going to happen. Despite Woody Allen and all that horribleness, Cate Blanchett will probably win Best Actress, don't you think?
Oh, yes. And she won Best Actress at the BAFTAs as well. Judi Dench for Philomena did not win.
Oh, well, there you go. See, there you go. That's very telling. If you can't beat her there at the BAFTAs, she doesn't have a chance in hell of winning here in America. I think that's pretty safe to say.
I think you're probably right about that. They give awards for Best British Short Film.
Breast?
Hey,
Good
you
Lord.
Know what? I was hoping you would overlook that, and thank you very much for
We got kids
sake.
Listening here.
Yeah, well...
Don't mention body parts.
Oh, okay. Can I mention American Hustle? Because it won Best Screenplay.
Sure. All right. Well, yeah. Okay. So, yeah. So, that's it. I think the big awards went to the big British stars. I don't think we've got any more clarity, but we do know that China is coming into its own in film. I mean, it certainly had a lot of great directors over the decades, especially in the last 20, 30 years. They've really come into their own.
You buried the lead here. You know who won Best Supporting Actor?
No, who?
Barkhad Abdi at the BAFTAs from Captain Phillips.
The
Somali pirate.
Is that the lead?
No, Best Supporting Actor in 2014.
Is that the lead of the biggest news?
It is because
you're Barkhad Abdi.
Yes, exactly.
I don't think that means he's going to win Best Supporting Actor, though anything can happen in the supporting actor categories. Again, these are not people who vote for the Oscars by and large. There's a tiny, tiny little bit of overlap. If you had the two circles in a Venn diagram, I imagine the sliver in the middle would be pretty small.
Right, and I would point out a couple of things here. In documentary, The Act of Killing one, this is the Indonesian film,
which I've seen and liked a lot.
Liked a lot. It's one of those things.
I loved it. I thought it was fascinating.
It is fascinating, yes. However, The Square was not nominated here. Best Actor, Chiwetel Ejiofor won, as I mentioned. However, Matthew McConaughey was not nominated since that film, Dallas Buyers Club, was not released yet.
There you go. Right. Again, one more reason to know that this is not a telling predictor of the Oscars.
True, although that would be, kind of presuming that the Oscars were the most important awards ceremony going all over the world, as opposed to in England, where the BAFTAs might be the more important award.
Absolutely. I'm sure they care about their more award more. I don't know. I think I'd still rather have an Oscar.
But you were trying to take us...
I think the West End is quite is the equal of Broadway, but I think the Oscar is still the biggest movie award, even bigger than Cannes. I think I'd rather win Best Picture.
True.
I love Cannes. I love England. I'm British, for God's sake. But still, it's like Wimbledon. That is it, man. That is the tennis championship. You got your U.S. Open and your French Open and your Australian, but Wimbledon is it.
True.
I don't care where you are in the world. That is the most prestigious tennis competition in the world. It's great. Of course, you want to win the U.S. Open, but you'd love to win Wimbledon. So, yeah, no. It's not a slight on England to say that the Oscars is the biggest movie awards in the world.
Well, I know you were trying to take us across the channel to Germany.
Yes.
And somehow, in Germany, you're going to swing past China.
Well, China was the big news. They won the top prize at the Berlin Film Festival, and they won the runner-up prize, yes. And they won Best Actor.
Okay, so three. They had a hat trick of awards at the Berlinale.
That's right. What were the movies?
I have no idea.
Oh, well, okay.
No, Black Coal Thin Ice was the movie that, I guess, took home the Silver Bear.
Right. This is about a drunken former detective, and it won Best Picture and won Best Actor. And then another movie, Blind Massage, was the runner-up film. They had three films in competition. So, of course, it was a great day for China. But the Chinese news media was kind of like, it's very good news, right, I think? Because, you know, these movies were not flag-waving exemplars of China's greatness. They were complex, real movies. And in fact, one of the movies in competition, No Man's Land, had been banned for 4 years in China because it was considered too nihilistic. So they weren't sure how much they were supposed to applaud their own movies because they weren't sure how the government felt about it. So eventually when a Chinese party organ said, oh, this is great news, then they all said, yay! So it tells you they've got a long way to go, but a healthy film industry is certainly a good first step. Creative people in the arts speaking out, being able to get these movies made and released worldwide. Hey, it'd be nice if No Man's Land got released in China, right? It probably was at this point. I don't know. It's playing in Berlin. Perhaps it's actually played in China now. But, you know, they've got a long way to go before they've got a free country, and they don't. But they've got a lot of success in film, and the more freedom these artists have, the more success they have worldwide, I think the more confident they will be to speak openly and honestly about the country that they live in.
Right, because we talk about this subject all the time. Our podcast is banned in China.
Oh, is it really?
No, I'm kidding. I have no idea.
Oh, that would be awesome.
you want to be banned in China, don't you?
I'd be proud.
Well, you know, whether these movies play in China or not, I am sure for the filmmakers, they consider this an achievement and that it's quite important to them.
Oh, it's huge. And Berlin's been very favorable to China over the years. I mean, they won the top prize, I think, like 20 years ago or something like that. So it's been really supportive of the Chinese film industry as they come into their own. And there's certainly been a lot of talented filmmakers. So I think for them, it's certainly a big deal.
Ooh, okay. All right. Well, I threw you a softball there and I was waiting for you to pick up on it. And you did. Because I was trying to move us along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story actually could have been kind of one of our lead stories. Actress Ellen Page of Juno and X-Men fame came out as gay, saying she didn't like to lie by omission. And those are her words, lie by omission.
She must be a Catholic if she's talking about sins of omission or commission.
I have
no idea.
So
that's interesting. I should look that up. Keep talking.
Interestingly, she talked about an E! Online story mocking her fashion sense. Apparently, Paige was photographed wearing some sweatpants and some sweat clothes on her way to the gym, and she kind of highlighted that as one example of how actors are pressured to conform. When E! Covered the story of Paige coming out, they made no mention of her mention of their contribution to her unhappiness. The news received wide press coverage in a matter-of-fact way, and then completely ended. Along with an X-Men sequel, Paige has two movies in the works, including Free Held, the story of a car mechanic who gets involved in a court battle to secure the pension benefits she would be due from her lover, Julianne Moore, after Moore is diagnosed with cancer. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop.
What?
And isn't that nice?
That's,
I mean, it's
true.
Seriously, it's just, people are like, oh, Ellen Page came out as gay, and next in the news.
Right.
I think it hurt? Mm-hmm.
I think a part of that, and I know you were going to probably go on to say, will it hurt her career because she can't, well, she can play romantic leads and, you know, will she be offered romantic leads?
Yeah, she's cute as a button. She's not one of these actors who came out who, like, had no chance at an action film career or that sort of romantic lead role. She's, an attractive, appealing actress.
Yeah, and I think a lot of journalists here in Los Angeles and who cover the film industry knew she was gay. She traveled everywhere with her girlfriend, so it wasn't a big...
Well, I didn't know.
It wasn't a big surprise. What I kind of like is there are certain actors who have not... I'm trying to think of one. Jodie Foster is probably the most obvious, where, uh-huh. You know what? It's just kind of off limits. You don't talk about it. It's their... Whatever they want to do, that's up to them, and there's no... unlike Tom Cruise, where everybody is constantly ruminating on whether he's gay or not.
People have ruminated on Jodie Foster for decades.
Right, but they kind of have stopped doing that. And
well, because she came out.
When did she come out? Oh, yeah, well, I guess she did come out.
Yeah, she came out. Yeah. No, the point is we don't care about Ellen Page's private life. I don't care who she's dating. I don't care how their relationship is going. I don't want to read about their romance or their breakup or their fights or whatever. Her private life is her private life. She's not talking about her private life. She's just stating a simple fact. Like, she's a woman. Like, she's white. She is gay. That's it. That's just a simple fact. That's not delving into her private life or gossip. And it's a matter of fact thing that you have to lie about or be honest about. And she's saying, I'm tired of lying about it. I don't necessarily want to share my private life with you, but I don't want to hide something as basic as this from the world and feel like a hypocrite. And I just looked it up. She was she chose to go to a Buddhist school as a kid. So clearly not raised Catholic, I don't think. But she studied meditation and yoga and went to a Buddhist school as a child. So that's her background as far as faith and philosophy. Well, and good for her.
Well, let me ask you, did you actually watch her speech? She kind of gave a speech to a...
No, I didn't. I'm sort of off the grid as far as television.
No, it wasn't on television.
Well, I could look at it online, yeah.
Yeah, it was mostly on YouTube, and it was a very good speech. She gave a kind of a strong speech. She was very nervous and gave a very heartfelt speech. And in the comments section was probably one of the funnier jokes that said, well, what'd you know about that? Spelled J-U-N-O.
Oh.
What'd you know? Because she was in Juno.
See? I got it. Yeah. All right, so moving on. It's not a big whoop. Why are we still talking about it?
I don't know. Jimmy Fallon made his debut last night as the host of The Tonight Show with Will Smith as a guest and you two performing.
Did you watch it?
It's on TiVo.
Okay.
It was a modest launch, but somehow achieved huge ratings, perhaps due to the intense media interest and a massive audience fed to it by the Olympics. Fallon matched Conan O'Brien's launch of The Tonight Show in the chair, though, of course, it may take months or even a year to see where late night is headed. That's how long it took Letterman to come back to Earth after switching from NBC to CBS, and for Leno to retake the lead for good. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, well, it's a big whoop as far as the ratings. Obviously, it means nothing. We'll have to see where he lands in the week and months to come. I didn't get to see the show yet. Again, I'm traveling. I've cut the cord. I don't have access to cable television. I don't know what to do with myself. It's driving me crazy.
We're going to be talking a little bit more about cutting the cord during Inside Baseball.
That's right. And of course, the show after him is Seth Meyers. That just seems such a bland, oh my God, you know, really? And so Seth Meyers is going to be following him, and he's got Fred Armisen. Oh, I didn't even know he was a musician.
Yeah, he's.
And he's going to sing and he's going to play music, whatever. So he's going to be his band leader. So that's the show following Jimmy Fallon. Could there be anything more bland than these, you know, two white guys from Saturday Night Live doing the late night talk show? It just feels so generic, them and Jimmy Kimmel. And thank God for Craig Ferguson.
Yes. Well, you know, it does seem to me that on CBS, you have David Letterman, who is in charge of late night. On NBC, you have...
obviously, Lorne Michaels.
Lorne Michaels. Yeah. Precisely. That's exactly where I was headed with that.
Yeah.
Well, now Penguin. This next story is about Penguin, and I don't.
Oh,
mean,
this is bad.
I don't mean the bird. Okay,
or the villain from Batman.
That's true, because in a case that has sent repercussions throughout India, the publishing company Penguin dropped its fight against a lawsuit brought by a far right activist over the scholarly work "The Hindus: An Alternative History," and it was by an American author, Wendy Doniger. The book was called Blasphemous. Instead of continuing to fight the case in courts, Penguin agreed to remove the book from the Indian market and to pulp the copies it already had on hand. And to pulp means, I guess, they're going to shred them up and turn them back into recycled paper. Liberal activists were outraged that Penguin didn't explore all legal options before caving in. Two Indian authors have pushed to cancel their contracts with the publisher in protest. Is this a big deal or a big whoop? I'm gauging from your initial response, Michael, that it's a big deal.
Yes, it is a big deal. It's very sad news. I think the big picture, we've seen some other things like a pullback of gay rights in India, some other censorship issues that were going on in TV and movies. And we know that the election is coming up. The far right is expected to take power. I think Penguin was looking at the big issue and how do they want to get along with the people in government and who's going to be in power for the next few years. And they made a business decision. And it's very sad. It seems like the wrong thing to do. I don't think you lose any sway with them by just saying, well, we want to go through the court process first. But they caved long before that. And it just seems like a very bad precedent to set. And it seems like they're just playing politics and looking at who's going to be the big guy. I mean, look at this book. I mean, this is from Booklist. They describe the book as lavishly detailed, dynamic, and encompassing. Doniger's multidimensional history celebrates Hindu wisdom, diversity, and pluralism with knowledge, insight, and passion.
Were you speaking English there? Because there were a lot of words in there that had lots of syllables.
Oh, sorry about that. But celebrating Hindu wisdom, diversity, and pluralism. The part of that that these people don't like is pluralism, because they don't want any but their own fundamentalist narrow version of Hinduism to prevail. And so it's a very sad day for India and for Penguin Publishing.
Well, speaking of sad news, you know, I love that we open with obits every week now, and somehow Shia LaBeouf has seemed to make it into every one of our podcasts this
year.
We
should just call him LaBeouf. Drop the Shia. I think it's just, he's now LaBeouf.
Yeah, well, I'm waiting for him to kind of copy our podcast, because you know that's coming. Shia LaBeouf is actually getting all Marina Abramovich on us. He's opened an art installation called Hashtag I Am Sorry here in Los Angeles for a week.
Oh, I wish you had gone.
You know, I thought about it and I was like, why? Why would I do that?
Because it would just... Okay, yeah, keep going.
I drove past it and I saw everybody standing outside and was like, really? But I guess people were invited to come in to this very small gallery. They were invited to choose a themed implement. So it were a props. And I guess they had, a whip for Indiana Jones, a Transformers toy, or a tweet mocking LaBeouf. So they had little slips of paper with tweets on him. And then they could go into an even smaller room where he was sitting there. The actor was sitting there with a paper bag on his head, the same paper bag that he walked the red carpet at the Berlinale.
Yeah, we don't know that.
It was. He kind of mentioned it. Yeah.
Okay.
And throughout the week, it got more tattered as the week went on. So this paper bag was sitting on his head, the one that says, I am not famous anymore. And apparently LaBeouf would sit there and listen to whatever you had to say to him without responding. He didn't say a word. And here's the thing that I would do. Might I suggest giving him your review of, say, Disturbia or Transformers, Revenge of the Fallen, or maybe his TV show, Even Stevens? He might have something to say about that, or he might cry, which apparently he did quite a lot. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop, but you didn't mention the Jerry O'Connell thing. I mean, Jerry O'Connell, for Funny or Die, did his own art installation, next door, doing the same thing, but his paper bag says, I'm really, really famous, or something like that, and it's just a big goof on it. But I kind of think they don't get the joke, because LaBeouf is clearly joking here. I mean, he is not, joking in the sense of, you know what I mean? I mean, this is a shtick, this is a performance art. And right. I don't know if they recognize that, because his hashtag is I'm sorry too, and he's riffing
on Jerry
LaBeouf's,
O'Connell's.
On LaBeouf's, riffing on Abramovich. I mean, and of course, this whole thing, I'm sorry, again, lifting ideas from Abramovich in a way that's differently contextualized and is fine, LaBeouf. That's not the point. I like everything he's done except for the initial stealing, which he still doesn't seem to recognize as what it is.
Right. And the more he does this, the more he calls out the fact that he's never really owned up to the fact that he...
Well, that's true, but at least the things he's done since then are funny and playful and interesting.
Yeah, I think...
It's a lot more interesting than Transformers Revenge of the Fallen, I'll tell you that. I mean, come on. Those are some bad movies.
Yes, I did like the number of references to that movie, Transformers Revenge of the Fallen, and other Transformers movies in the Lego movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
There was a lot of clever touches in that film.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. I want to know, will it last? That's what everyone at NBC's The Today Show was asking themselves and has been asking themselves over the past week. The morning news program has been losing to Good Morning America for 2 years now, but the Olympics put them back on top. The margin of victory in the most important demos was even wider than their total audience victory. It helps to have Olympic champions all make a stop on the Today Show for a little chat, including former Russian Olympic champions, apparently, were stopping by for a little chat. As a bonus, Bob Costas, you know, the sportscaster, very famous sports announcer here in the U.S., he has an eye infection. What? Well, since that sidelined the actor, Matt Lauer got to sub in prime time for him, extending today's visibility even more, because Matt Lauer is, of course, the host of the Today Show. But before NBC could celebrate, Good Morning America beat NBC on a Tuesday. The first time the network hosting the Olympics here in the United States has lost the morning news race even for one day, even a single day. It's never happened.
In the history of the Olympics.
Yeah.
They've never lost. And ABC beat. They're like, oh, this is going to keep on. This is oh, shoot.
Well, NBC did win the key advertiser demo, but still. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, clearly it's a big whoop. I mean, since they weren't even able to maintain it. The ratings have been down for 15 to 20% from Vancouver. They're a little down from Torino, which was the Olympics before that. Just last night, the Fallon's debut night, that was the first day that the Olympics scored higher ratings than Vancouver. That was 11 days of losses. Finally, they've had a day where they were in the plus column. So that's a nice good news. Matt Lauer did substitute for him. So did Meredith Vieira, which brings up a question. Why was Savannah Guthrie? Is that her name? Savannah?
I couldn't tell you right now. Who hosts Today Show?
Well, it's Savannah, whatever. Savannah, replaced Meredith Vieira, who stepped down willingly and said, I want to be with my husband, whatever. But at the Olympics opening ceremony, which is the biggest night for the Olympics, there was Meredith Vieira next to Matt Lauer. And I'm like, well, why isn't it somebody else from the Today? Why is it not Savannah? Why is it Meredith Vieira? And then she actually substituted for Bob Casas herself. So one of the nights she was the sole host, the first time a woman, which is kind of sad in and of itself, but the first time a woman hosted the Olympics coverage for a major network here in the U.S. on their own. And again, I thought, if you're trying to promote Today and trying to get those people back in, boy, I don't know, did Matt and Savannah not get along or what's going on there? But why are you touting Meredith Vieira, who has no big role at NBC? I love her. I think she's great. I'm sure they'd love her back at Today's show, except for Savannah. But I just found that all very puzzling.
Well, yeah. I mean, I've heard a number of people over the past couple of months say that the Today Show has turned into The View. It's just a bunch of people gabbing.
Yeah.
But speaking of women, a woman in South Carolina was arrested for an overdue movie rental. Boy, do I love this story. Kayla Finley of Pickens, South Carolina, rented the Jennifer Lopez, Jane Fonda flick, Monster-in-Law, and then promptly forgot about it.
It happens.
Kind of like that movie's audience. That ultimately generated an arrest warrant. So when Finley came to the police station in Pickens to report a crime, they spotted the outstanding warrant and promptly threw her in jail. I'm sorry. I can't not make this into a joke. Shouldn't they have arrested her for renting Monster-in-Law in the first place?
Ba-dum-bum.
Thank you. I'm in town all week. Don't forget to tip your waitress. Try the veal. You know, it was between that and shouldn't they have arrested her for still renting a VHS tape in 2005?
Was it a VHS tape?
Yes, it was. Or something about how...
She must have gone to the Blockbuster.
Right, exactly. Something about how Kayla Finley, put video stores out of business. I don't know. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Whoop.
Okay. Well, talk about high expectations. The Hollywood Reporter had a story analyzing the fall of The X Factor. Remember, we were just talking last week about how they canceled that show. Fox canceled this kind of...
The American version of The X Factor.
Right. So they canceled it in the U.S., and the story was about how Simon Cowell failed to find a new home for the show, even pitching the show here in the U.S. to NBC, the home of The Voice, and Cowell's America's Got Talent. He produces that show. But in discussing how hard the show fell in its three seasons on the air, they tallied up the ad sales the show pulled in. Now get this, despite a soft launch and falling ratings, it earned $500 million in ad revenue the very first season. Now, it was down the second season to $386 million and $139 million in the third season.
That's a precipitous fall.
Yes. So you could see where, the writing was on the wall there. However, that's more than $1 billion in 3 years. Even with Cowell being paid tens of millions of dollars, there's surely a lot of profit left over for the show, which is still a hit in 45 countries. Even bigger is the hit... the Got Talent franchise, their hits all over 193 countries this show airs in. Not America's Got Talent, but they have little franchises.
America's Got Talent, Britain's Got Talent, Spain's Got Talent, you name it.
Everybody's talented.
Yeah, we're all talented.
But us. Anyway, still, $1 billion for a flop like X Factor sounds pretty amazing, don't you think? Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. I think the show ran for 3 years and they grossed $1 billion on it. Oh my God. That doesn't even count sales, like album sales, which is not large yet. But they've had single sales and other stuff, and I'm sure merchandise. And, clearly the writing was on the wall. Clearly it was failing, but they certainly did not spend, $500 million making the show, right? I mean,
no.
I'm sure it costs a lot. You have to audition some numerous cities. It's elaborate. It's expensive. But still, $1 billion. They must have netted at least $500 million on that.
Well, even if they netted...
Talk about a flop. I mean, I could use more flops like that.
Well, even if they netted $250 million, that's still a lot of money over...
They didn't spend $250 million a year putting on, The X Factor. There's no way.
I don't know. I think really what happened is, you know, Simon Cowell was leaving, and they said, well, there's no point in
No. I think they were right to shut it down, even if he'd stayed. I mean, you know, come on, 500 to 386 to 139. You know, now you're going to start losing money. Then why lose? Why give up some of the money you've already made?
True.
You know, so I think that I think it was the right call. It should go even before he announced he was leaving. It didn't make any sense. It was just too low in the ratings. Oh, well.
Well, remarkably, you know, we're still under an hour. So,
well, we haven't done our guest yet.
That's true, because we're wrapping up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week, and we are moving along to Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business, and more importantly, how they affect you. David Gelis, a business reporter for the New York Times, whose previous stints at the Financial Times and Miami Herald, covering such big things as mergers and acquisitions, make him the perfect journalist to help us sort out this Comcast, Time Warner cable mess. Gelis is also the author of Mindful Work, which examines companies such as Google, General Mills, and Green Mountain Coffee to chart the dramatically increasing impact of Eastern wisdom, like meditation, yoga, and more, on Western businesses. Mindful Work is due out later this year from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Talk about mergers and acquisitions. David, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so David, basically we have the number one company in cable acquiring the number two cable company in the country for about $45 billion. And the question is, will the merger get approved? I mean, it seems like after some symbolic shedding of a couple million subscribers that everyone seems to think this will get a green light from the Obama administration. Is that your take on it?
It's rather extraordinary, but that's exactly the sentiment on Wall Street thus far. People think that even though this is a 1-2 merger of cable operators, that it likely will get approved. Now, there's reasons to think that might be the case and reasons to think that might not be the case. Taking the view that maybe there are some real hurdles ahead, this administration, in fact, has been relatively aggressive in pursuing antitrust enforcement. You look at the airline deal that was blocked, a beer deal required several significant concessions. So the Obama administration has not been afraid to stand up and say, no, this, you know, consolidation is not necessarily good for the consumer. In this case, however, the cable companies are making the argument that because they don't compete zip code by zip code, because there's no market where you have the choice between Time Warner Cable and Comcast, that in fact, there really is no harm to the consumer being done here. It also bears noting that Brian Roberts, the CEO of Comcast, is known to be an associate and even friend of President Obama, and that a senior executive at Comcast is one of Obama's bundlers. So there are close ties between Comcast and this administration as well.
Well,
so,
by
that logic, if they bought every other cable company in the country, it wouldn't reduce competition because they were the only one. It wasn't like people had a choice anyway with their cable provider.
Well, I don't know about that. They certainly do compete with other cable operators in certain markets, just not Time Warner Cable. And they would also make the argument that we're seeing the sharp rise of other competitors, namely DirecTV, Dish, and even the telecommunications companies like AT&T and Verizon, which have their own growing TV services.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess I was discussing this with Michael before we started recording here, that it's kind of like being outmaneuvered in a bad chess match where your opponent has convinced you to give up, to create these geographic monopolies, which they've effectively done, the cable companies, that is. And then all of a sudden they're saying, well, but we're not competitors. Well, yeah, because you asked us wait a second. You asked us to give you that monopoly in different areas. It just seems all very underhanded, I suppose.
I'm not going to weigh in as to whether this is above board or below board, but I think it is fair to say that several decades of regulation have played a big role in establishing a landscape where we do have essentially regional monopolies that do not compete with one another very much. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing for consumers is what the antitrust officials in Washington, D.C. are going to have to figure out over the next many months.
Yeah, and I guess maybe I shouldn't have said underhanded. That's probably the wrong word. I guess disingenuous is the word Paul Krugman, your colleague there at the New York Times, said.
I would draw a sharp distinction between my colleagues on the editorial page and what we do here in the news department.
Well, one of the arguments as to why this is not necessarily unreasonable is that the new competition comes not just from satellite and telephone companies, but from streaming services and online websites like Netflix and Hulu, and Amazon is just, you know, launched another batch of pilots. So that argument says, well, look, there's a lot of competition for providing this sort of entertainment. It's not just other cable companies or satellite and things like that. But of course, the counter argument is, well, yeah, but they're the gatekeeper as far as the internet. You know, when you talk about who gets into your home, you're going to have to pay Comcast anyway.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we believe that antitrust officials are going to look very closely at, perhaps more closely than television services even, is the online portion. Because with this acquisition completed, Comcast would by a large measure be the largest provider of high-speed internet in the country. And this comes at a time, of course, as you guys know, when the way people access entertainment is just fundamentally changing, and we're doing more and more of it exponentially over the web, not necessarily through those old cable lines. But net neutrality is absolutely at the center of what people are concerned about here. Could Comcast eventually, you know, use their power with the pipes to preference their content over competitors' content? That's a question people have been asking even before the NBCU deal was done, and it's something that's going to be continually scrutinized as Comcast grows only bigger.
Speaking of net neutrality and this issue, the FCC lost this big case, Verizon v. FCC, and last week, Tom Wheeler, the chairman of the FCC and former cable guy, by the way, he said,
of course,
yeah, he said, the Court of Appeals invited the commission to act to preserve a free and open internet. I accept that invitation. And in the coming days, I will be outlining how I propose to proceed. Do you think this merger, this proposed merger between Comcast and Time Warner, Comcast with 22 million subscribers, Time Warner Cable with 11.5 million subscribers, do you think this might be a good opportunity or a chance for the FCC to kind of instill some of its will here?
I'm sure it's going to be a big part of the discussion. When you have any deal this transformative, I think just about everything gets put on the table. And as we said in a piece in, I believe, Saturday's paper, Comcast is going to bend over backwards to ensure it is going to be seen, you know, in the good graces. It wants to be in the good graces of every different constituency
right.
group. That means regulators, that means competitors, that means partners, that means content providers, and it means other distributors. So we saw a number of lengthy concessions that were part of the NBCU deal, and I expect we'll see quite a few concessions that are part of this one as well.
Well, at the time that Comcast and Time Warner announced this merger, Charter Communications, another cable provider, was making kind of a more hostile takeover attempt at Time Warner and had reached out to Comcast and said, hey, let's do this together. Comcast said, well, actually, we don't need you. Why was Charter going after Time Warner Cable? And why would Comcast want Time Warner Cable? What is the advantage for either of them? And what is the advantage for Time Warner to kind of be consumed in this merger?
Well, the backstory here is really some of the most fascinating parts of this whole deal. If you look at Charter, Charter was essentially a regional cable operator, 6 million subscribers or so, give or take, in the South for the most part. But last year, Liberty Media, the media conglomerate run by John Malone, former billionaire, former CEO of TCI, which was at the time the largest cable operator in the country about 15 years ago, he bought a 27% stake in Charter, his group did, and they essentially started maneuvering and saying, listen, this industry needs consolidation. There's lots of reason for it. The industry, the kind of table is set for consolidation, and we want to be a part of it. What proceeded, though, what transpired over the last 8 months, really, was essentially a very slow courtship. Charter made three separate offers to Time Warner Cable, but as one person close to the whole situation told us last Thursday, they kept coming in a day late and a dollar short. Their offers were never much higher, if at all, than Time Warner Cable's share price currently, and they never came in with the, quote, kill shot. They never offered a significant premium to where the stock was trading at the time. So they kind of chased the stock for months and months. If they had offered $132.50 a share, which was their last and most recent public offer made in January, if they had offered that number back last July, say, this thing would have been sewn up. Charter probably would have had it. But just strategically, they unfortunately were outmaneuvered in the end by Comcast. Comcast, on the other hand, you know, always has thought potentially about a deal with Time Warner Cable. They like these markets. This will get Comcast into Los Angeles and New York for the first time. But Brian Roberts, the CEO, was frankly hesitant to embark on such a big transformative deal just a year after completing the NBCU transaction. What happened in the last couple months really got this whole thing going. Charter approached Comcast, said, hey, if you want to pick up a couple key markets, we could do a deal together. Comcast considered it, but was uncomfortable with the hostile approach Charter was taking. And then a couple of critical things happened. In January, Rob Marcus, the CEO of Time Warner Cable, reached out to Brian Roberts, said, let's sit down, let's try to get this done. A couple meetings happened, they couldn't get all the way there, and Comcast walked away. By the end of January, it looked like Comcast might not do any deal at all, might not partner with Comcast, might not go it alone. But then at the end of January, Brian Roberts went out to meet his shareholders after announcing full year results. And what he heard surprised him. All his major shareholders, maybe not all, but most of them, were supportive of a deal. They said, we need consolidation. Why are you guys going to sit on the sidelines? Why don't you be a part of it? So they actually encouraged him to go out and get the whole thing. And then in just a matter of days, early this month, negotiations happened at a very quick pace. And the two companies announced, you know, kind of took the whole media landscape by surprise last week, announcing it early Thursday morning.
Yeah, well, negotiations are at the heart of it. And we've seen a lot of them between cable companies and channels or networks. And it seems like the biggest channels, like a major network like CBS or NBC or ESPN, they've got the leverage in these negotiations. But there are hundreds of smaller channels that do not have a lot of leverage. We just saw, I think it was DirecTV dump the Weather Channel, and they've got their own channel. Obviously, if you get a bigger channel like Comcast, if the cable provider becomes bigger, they'll be in a better negotiating position, even with the big titans like ESPN and CBS and NBC. But I can see how this might also tip over into negotiations with the smaller channels. I mean, right now they pay these smaller channels a certain amount per subscriber, and that's what they fight over. But if I was launching a new cable channel and I came to one of these big cable providers, I could imagine today them saying, well, why don't you pay us to be on our cable channel? Because you're going to make all that ad revenue. So you should be paying us for the privilege to be on our cable slot. Is there anything that would stop that from happening?
Well, that would be a huge reversal of the status quo, and I certainly haven't heard anything to that effect happening yet. But the point that a deal like this will give Comcast more leverage in those negotiations is absolutely accurate. And one of the things, as you noted, that has been happening in the media industry is the content guys and the distributors are fighting. Content guys want more money for their programming. The distributors are resisting. But in many cases, CBS, Time Warner Cable last year, they need CBS on the air, and they eventually wind up paying. Now, this is, the distributors would argue, a big reason cable bills have been going up. They say, you know, we'd love to pay less for these channels, and we'd love to pass along savings to the consumer, is their logic. But the content guys are not letting that happen. If you look at the escalation in fees that the distributors are paying to the content guys, it's quite startling, no question about it. It's worth noting also, however, that Comcast, because it owns a cable network, or a whole family of cable networks and a broadcast network, of course, many people believe it's a bit more sympathetic to the concerns of content providers. And Comcast executives would point out that they have never pulled out a channel off the air in the midst of a retrans dispute, as Time Warner Cable and now DirecTV have done.
Right, and that we should point out to listeners, that is what we're discussing here, these retransmission disputes. How much of an issue was that, or how much did that play, that dispute between CBS and Time Warner Cable that lasted about a month in August last year? How much did that play into Time Warner being vulnerable for a takeover?
Time Warner Cable.
Sorry, Time Warner Cable, I realize. The biggest winner in all of this, by the way, is the media will no longer have to deal with confusing the two. But how much did that play a part of Time Warner Cable's vulnerability?
Nothing I've heard suggests that was a big part of the calculation here.
I know you're on the business side and there's the opinion side, but I wonder, the people like Paul Krugman are saying, why would we even think about letting it go through? And when and why did we stop worrying about monopoly power? Is there any merger like this that could happen that would surprise you anymore, since it seems like it's a fait accompli? And it just seems to be the new world we live in. Once they start to happen, then you just say, oh, well, that's what's happening.
I think it's an incredibly complex issue, and it's, of course, not as simple as, you know, a big company shouldn't get any bigger. The factors at play here, ranging from, you know, the true fact that Time Warner Cable and Comcast don't compete zip code by zip code, that's a real issue. That suggests that perhaps, you know, consumers are not going to face higher costs as a result of reduced competition. Now, does that mean we shouldn't be wary about letting one big company control the flow of that much information? Absolutely not. But I think, you know, opponents need to be very precise in their arguments and not just say that the fact that one company is getting bigger is a bad thing in and of itself.
Right.
But isn't that what regulations do? They say one company cannot control TV and radio and television in this market. One company cannot control 80% of the newspapers in the country. One company cannot control that too much of media power invested in one company in a certain area like television or newspapers or radio. That's what we have a lot of rules about, saying, no, that's not acceptable. That is too big, period. It is as simple as that. Right. You do not want to have one company control every newspaper in the country. You don't want to have one company control 80% of the radio or television market. So do you want to have one company control 30% of cable going into people's homes? And much more importantly, the internet.
And as you say, that's something that Mr. Wheeler himself is going to have to think long and hard about in the coming months. But as far as I understand it, there's currently no regulation that would prevent them from, you know, having a more dominant market share when it comes to distribution. I think the concern historically has been on the content side. We don't want, you know, a media baron controlling what is published in all these markets. But historically, I think there have actually been some attempts. There was a now struck rule that said cable operators, I believe, couldn't have more than 30% of the national market. Don't believe that regulation exists anymore. Right now, I don't think there's anything on the books that actually pertains to market share when it comes to distribution. Now, does that mean that there shouldn't be? Not for me to say.
Well, and you mentioned that Comcast shareholders were saying, gee, we need consolidation. Why is it that shareholders or the industry might say, gee, we need some consolidation in this market? What is driving that urge or that necessity?
They put forward a couple arguments. One is, as we talked about earlier, the need for more leverage, really, against the content companies who are demanding ever higher fees. Another one is really kind of on a technological and user experience level. The cable experience, as you guys well know, it has not evolved much in decades now. And a lack of shared standards, a lack of dialogue between a lot of the cable operators, many people feel like has kind of stagnated growth. Now, could competition also provide some of that growth in local markets? Perhaps. But as we know, that's not really the way the landscape is teed up just now. So they believe that by consolidating, they'll be able to kind of share knowledge, roll out more, better user experiences to a greater number of users. Those are some of the arguments they use for consolidation.
And he who controls the pipeline controls the content. That's what we're seeing with net neutrality and the questioning of that, and the fact that the more power you have over the pipeline into people's homes, the more you can affect which channels appear, which channels appear quickly, which channels appear with preference, and therefore influence what people are seeing. So content and access to content seem inextricably linked these days.
Potentially.
Absolutely.
Well, let me ask you something. In the motion picture industry, there is the Paramount Decree, which kind of did away with vertical integration in 1948. I suppose that does not play a part here with this type of media consolidation, because it's not movie theaters and movie studios, but it still is kind of a vertical integration of some type.
You own a major network, you own the cable channel, and you own the internet.
Well, and this ship sailed a few years ago when the NBCU deal got done. So that part I don't believe is anything new. Right now we're just talking about the distribution side of Comcast getting larger.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Well, certainly it'll be fascinating to see this play out. Do you have any predictions as to what concessions you think might be asked for?
Absolutely not.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to at least help us explain it. I know we kind of came at you more opinionated, and I think I'm at least leaving a little bit more objective, I suppose, is the proper word. I can, if I can find proper words today. Now, David, you can be found on Twitter at dgellis, correct?
Correct.
And when does your book, when is it going to be hitting bookstores?
Probably a little later than late this year. We're now aiming for early next year.
Well, David Gellis, a business reporter for the New York Times, and the book we're talking about is Mindful Work. We will remind everybody when it's published. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that was very nice of David Gellis from the New York Times to join us. I was wondering who we could get to speak about this, and I've been reading his work in the New York Times for a while now, like a couple months, and I found it fascinating. And he is very, I have to say, a true journalist, very objective, and I appreciate that.
Well, that's their job. He's not allowed to express opinion. I guess if we wanted someone to breathe fire, we should have called up Paul Krugman.
Yeah, he was really kind of a, I thought, gee, I don't know if this is good. I don't know if this merger, is it the right thing? Is it? And gee, you talk to Paul Krugman, it's definitely not the right thing.
Yeah, I'm with him on that one.
And, you know, this all kind of reminded me of a book I read called The Master Switch by Tim Wu. And this is a book, it's a fascinating book and well worth reading and picking up. And it really talks about the evolution of technology adoption and how technology evolves over time. It kind of talks about how the same fates befall the telephone, radio, and eventually the television industry. And here's the quote from it. It says, "History shows a typical progression of information technologies from somebody's hobby to somebody's industry, from jury-rigged contraption to slick production marvel, from a freely accessible channel to one strictly controlled by a single corporation or cartel, from open to closed system." And I would say that's exactly what's happening here.
Well, I'm not sure how television went from an open to a closed system. It was always a high entry point. You know, you needed a lot of money and programming and equipment to enter television. It's not quite like radio, where you can have lots of small micro, you know, radio stations all over the country. TV, to me, does not seem like it was ever much of a hobby.
No, I would agree with that. Although it was a little bit easier to transmit, maybe, when it was just, you know, over-the-air signals.
And telephone, I guess you're talking about the cost of a telephone, but it's certainly pretty darn ubiquitous.
Well, there were hundreds of telephone companies, right? I mean, and they all kind of slowly began to be consumed, and much like cars, there were, you know, what, mm-hmm. 2-3 dozen car companies, and now there's 3. So, in the United States, that is.
Not counting Tesla and a bunch of others, I guess.
Correct. The big 3. Yes, you're absolutely correct.
That's it. So why do people overseas care about this? I guess it's mainly because Comcast is involved in television programming, and the more power cable companies or internet providers have, the more influence they'll have over the shows that are made, the channels that survive, and the TV and television stuff that gets broadcast around the world.
That's right. I mean, if all of a sudden Comcast doesn't want to air or carry MTV because it's a Viacom property, well, Viacom makes less money with MTV. Maybe MTV goes off the air, then it's
no real world. No real world.
Well, then it's not available in England or Spain or France.
You gotta have the real world.
Well, okay, fine. We'll give you MTV.
And cutting the cord is not easy. I've been traveling. I'm not living in my apartment right now. I'm a hobo. And believe me, I can't watch any of the Olympics.
Is hobo spelled with a capital H or... Is that a lower?
It's H-O-B-O, lowercase h.
Okay.
I cannot see any of the Olympics. I cannot. Turner Classic Movies has a great app where you can watch movies on demand, but you got to have a cable thing. You can't just pay for it. You can't just get it. You have to be a cable subscriber in order to access it.
And give you some sense as to what, and this is for those who live outside the United States, Comcast is not exactly a beloved company here. They have
hates their telephone provider. Everybody hates their cable provider. Everybody hates their health insurance plan.
Yes. You know? However, they have a lower customer service rating than the IRS as of last year. Okay. So, and that's the,
but this has nothing to do with Comcast. This is just cable and television in general.
No, but let me point out something about Comcast for a second and the Olympics, since you were on that topic. Mm-hmm. There have been several reports and articles written or blog posts written over the past week about how people who thought they could watch the Olympics because of TV everywhere and that they had Comcast, they were a subscriber to Comcast, but they weren't a subscriber to a high premium tier. So they didn't have HBO or they didn't have some, you know, they just had basic cable.
Right. No luck.
No luck. They had to subscribe to the one that's $100 a month instead of just $60. So they weren't allowed to watch the Olympics online.
I don't understand why NBC would not see it to their advantage to just have a website streaming their primetime coverage with all the ads in place. I know there are local ads and they would be substituting other things and their local channels would be upset. But, you know, if people only want to watch it online, You're just adding eyeballs that you wouldn't have otherwise and showing ads to them. You could charge for it. So I don't understand what the downside is. You're talking about people who don't subscribe to cable, right? You know, you're not going to suddenly make them subscribe to cable because once every 2 years the Olympics take place.
No, but I mean, it is one of the, you know.
Right, but nobody subscribes to cable because every 2 years there's going to be 12 days of the Olympics. Nobody, not one person.
No, as a matter of fact, I haven't watched a single moment of the Olympics.
Yeah, I've seen very little. But again, you know, people are not going to subscribe for 23 months out of the year because on the 24th month, there's going to be the Olympics. That does not happen. So what are you worried about by making it available online? Just there's the prime time. You want to click on the site and look at it. You know, you can't fast forward. You can't rewind. You just got to watch it. What's the harm?
Well, you know, Michael, you're asking a question, and maybe one of our listeners has the answer. And if they do, they can call us at 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Or you could write to us. You could email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And that is exactly what Kevin B. from Newport Beach, I assume that it's Newport Beach, California, that's exactly what Kevin B. did.
That's right. He said, "Hey, kids, not sure if you noticed this when you were talking about the Super Bowl's record viewership a few weeks ago, but the ratings didn't drop after the halftime show as they do traditionally. I didn't know that, by the way. What's especially interesting is that even though the game was such a blowout and so lopsided, ratings didn't decline. I'm probably not the first to suggest that this might be due to everyone watching the game while yakking away on social media like Twitter. I know I was, and the game was far more interesting because of it. Love the show. Keep up all the great work that you do. Kevin from Newport Beach." And that's a social media comment. It ties right into the next email. Why don't you read that one, Sperling, and then we'll discuss them both.
Michael and Sperling, was listening to your show last week, episode 224, the one with LA Times Scott Collins talking about Jay Leno saying sayonara. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, because it does seem like a foreign word. saying sayonara to late night, or is it the other way around? I just stepped on my own joke there, you know?
You stepped on his joke.
His joke, yes. Just wanted to throw in a comment here, because it's interesting to me that Jimmy Fallon, who is taking over The Tonight Show, comes from a background in sketch comedy on Saturday Night Live. And when he hosted Late Night, some of the best moments came while performing in little sketches. These bits were short and could be shared as clips on YouTube and the like. This only made Fallon more popular and more part of the culture. Guess what I'm saying is, I agree with your guest. Leno's monologue may have been about current events on a nightly basis, but it was delivered in a way that was current with the times, whereas Fallon and Jon Stewart on The Daily Show have figured out a way to capsulize their delivery for a modern audience. Talk amongst yourselves. Or as Sperling would say, see what I did there? Ryan.
So what Ryan is saying there is that Leno was not hip. He wasn't up with the times. He wasn't getting stuff, clips posted on YouTube. He wasn't doing good tweets. He wasn't current with the times, whereas Fallon and Stewart were communicating to people via social media. And that was certainly a big part about Jimmy Kimmel and why ABC moved him up to 11:30, because he had clips that would go viral and get a lot of, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of hits, and he would do clever tweets and things like that. And they felt that that was just as important to his currency as, you know, just the ratings. And
right.
So Leno was, you know, the past as that was concerned. And then you talk about the Super Bowl. I'm really surprised that people kept watching to the end. It was the highest rated Super Bowl because it was a blowout. It was a boring game. But the halftime show was most watched ever. Maybe part of it is, like Kevin says, people wanted to talk about it and tell people what they thought.
Or make funny jokes on Twitter.
Or make funny jokes. And so that kept them engaged even when the game wasn't a lot of fun. That's an interesting point. Thanks for making it. And certainly, you know, Ryan is right about the fact that Jimmy Fallon is geared more towards the internet and creating those clips that can be viewed in bits and pieces online so you don't have to watch the whole show. But even if you don't, you'll still find Jimmy Fallon popping up into your consciousness and thinking he's cool and hip and funny.
Well, I'd like to thank both Kevin B. and Ryan for writing into dirt@showbizsandbox.com. I'd also like to thank our guest, David Gelles from the New York Times, for joining us to talk about the proposed merger between Time Warner Cable and Comcast. I guess Comcast, who goes first in that one? I don't know. I guess Comcast.
Absolutely. They're bigger.
Right. Okay. Again, thanks to Ryan, Kevin B., and David Gelles. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or Stitcher. I guess it's not the Zune Marketplace anymore. It's the Microsoft Marketplace.
Then stop saying Zune.
I know. I should probably change that. But again, please do subscribe to the show, rate and review it in any of the podcast aggregators where our show is given away for free. Links to all of the stories, including David Gelis's stories, are in our show notes, which can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to email us, those ways to call us, those ways to follow us. We're actually on Twitter.
Ways to send us money.
Yes, you can donate to us as well.
Sure.
Our Twitter handle is at Showbiz Sandbox. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/showbizsandbox. So please follow us, rate and review us, subscribe to us, click on the links to all the stories we've talked about. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website.
I can be found on thegoodshiplollipop.com.
Oh, a Shirley Temple Black reference.
That's right.
Now, if you can't find Michael there, or if you can't find his writing there, try the Huffington Post or michaelgiltz.com. Some of my writing can be found at celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice. And remember,
everything is awesome.